Let's go back in and just walk through the dream recited. Let's start in verse 24. This is just now that everyone has a handout in front of them, let's take a look at the statue here. In verse 24 of chapter 2, therefore Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king." So Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows, "I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king." And the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation?" And Daniel answered before the king and said, "As for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king." Dr. Walbert had a note in his commentary that Daniel knew he's going to be hanging around with these guys for a long time to come, and some of them were elderly. He's a very young man. He's just a teenager at this point. Dr. Walbert takes the view that this dream was right about the time they had graduated, or maybe right before that time. So he's only, 16, 17, 19, 20 years of age. All these counselors in the king's court that had been around for years and years and years, he comes to their defense at this point and says, even though all these guys are hired to do this thing, to tell your dreams, all they do is sit around and dream dreams, and they're supposed to be able to tell you the dream. Nobody can do that. I mean, let's just face it. Let's be truthful here. Let's get our cards on the table, King. People have dreams. Nobody can tell a person's dream. It's impossible. So he comes to their aid, and then in verse 28, here's the punchline. So first he sets it up and says, all of these different classes of individuals that you've hired to tell your dreams, let's face it, they can't do it. I can't do it. However, verse 28, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while you're on your bed. There's an interesting play going on here in verse 28. As Martin pointed out earlier, some of these astrologers and astronomers, what do they devote their lives to doing? Studying the heavens, right? Because the heavens give them the answers to the secrets. And Daniel makes it very clear here, looking heavenward is a good thing to do, but not to the stars. You need to look to the God who created the stars. So he kind of sets it all up here by saying, these fellows are all paid to study the stars and to give you answers from the stars. Have you read your horoscope this morning? Please don't say you have. You ask that in church sometime and, you know, you get two or three, yeah. Oops, asked that in the wrong way. So Daniel is saying there is no one apart from God who can tell mysteries, but he will tell the king what is to take place in the latter days. This phrase, latter days, this is one of our key prophetic phrases, isn't it? What are the latter days? The latter days began with Babylon, and they'll run all the way through until the coming of Messiah, his first coming, the inter-Advent church age, which was not seen in the Old Testament by the Old Testament prophets, and then Christ's second coming, the Battle of Armageddon and all of its various stages, the establishment of his kingdom. All of that is the latter days. What's confusing about this term is that how did the latter days start from right here? Because Israel had been taken into captivity. And so their restoration, God starting to work with them again, the sending of Messiah, that's the first, what we call the first phase of the latter days. Did they accept him when he came? No, they didn't. So he postponed the establishment of the kingdom because they refused to repent and receive the king. He'll come again and they will receive him, individually and nationally, and he will establish the kingdom for them. So this phrase, the latter days, and what's the big brother of this phrase that we come across all the time when the prophets are speaking? In that day. The prophet can be speaking in his day. He can be speaking about the near prophetic future, such as the restoration of Israel from captivity. the first coming of Christ. In that day could be referring to the first coming of Christ, but it's used so many times primarily of that future, the end of the latter days. In that day when Messiah comes to make war against these Gentile nations that are represented in this statue. Gentile dominance over Israel, Gentile dominance over the world because we're a Gentile world. But so much of what biblical prophecy refers to, and especially here in the book of Daniel, has to do with God's dealing with his people Israel. Things aren't looking real good for Israel these days, are they? You're reading articles like the Times, British Times. The United Kingdom is advocating withdrawing all support for Israel. Just let them stand or fall on their own. And the U.S. now is entering into more negotiations and talks with the European Commonwealth. Where's that going to lead us? It's going to lead us into big trouble if we don't continue to champion Israel and stand with Israel. What are we going to do with this Iran threat? I think I read a letter. Didn't I read that to you last week? The letter from our missionary in Amman, Jordan. Andy says he expects in the next few months a strike by probably Israel against all the nuclear facilities in Iran. That's going to be interesting to watch that, isn't it? To see if all that happens. Watch the news. It's heating up over there. What did Iran do this a few days ago? Did they take a bunch of British?
15 yeah. British Marines.
They let them go yet?
No.
I don't
know.
No?
So they're over there, though.
Yeah, we got two aircraft carriers there. Isn't that interesting? Anyway.
Oh, right.
Well, I could sure lose control here. All right, let's jump back in here. We won't solve all these things, and just because they're over there, nothing may happen for another 10 years. I hope so, personally. I don't want to see chaos over there. We got to go on an Israel trip next summer. That'll sure ruin that. Well, verse 29 here. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future. There's our phrase, latter days, in verse 28. He who reveals mysteries has made known to you what's going to take place. So again, a reference to God. He is the one that can reveal it because he's the one that's going to bring it all to pass. But as for me, and here's Daniel's giving another exclusion here that I have nothing to do with interpreting this. Verse 30, as for me, the mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than in any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast, its arms of silver, its belly, its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. So there's the major parts of, he lists these in separate parts of this statue because he's going to, in the interpretation, assign a different ruling Gentile kingdom to each part of this. And then the disturbing part here is verse 34, you continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold, they were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled all the earth. Again, this verse, I want to highlight this. The destruction of this statue representing the Gentile kingdoms of the world, is that a gradual thing, or is it not instantaneous, cataclysmic, a one-time event? And that would raise the question then, if the Gentile world rulers of the world have been struck and destroyed, and this stone became a great mountain and filled the earth, has that happened yet? No, it's not. It seems that that is a future event. It is, as the book of Revelation describes it for us, a time of unprecedented destruction towards the end of the seven-year tribulation period, with Christ coming at the end of that time, leading up to his establishment of his kingdom on the earth. Notice this stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled all the earth. Look at verse 45. inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold. The great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future, so the dream is true and its interpretation is trustworthy. When is that going to happen? It's going to happen in the future. The question is, has that ever happened yet? Go to Jesus' words in the gospel. There's a future period of tribulation, time of trouble, called Jacob's distress, coming upon the world. Never before has there been a time like it, nor will there ever be again. Does that sound like he knew the book of Daniel? He wrote the book of Daniel. He is in control of human history. So this event has not happened. Those that want to say that after Jesus died and Rome came in and destroyed Jerusalem, that was the first phase of this, and there's been unrest, and it's unwrapping slowly, and this will ultimately all happen. That these verses don't allow for that. This is something yet future that will take place at the end of this future period of time, when this statue will be destroyed by this rock that's cut out that's going to come and destroy it. This is the dream. Now we'll tell the interpretation. Verse 37. You, O king, are king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And whatever the sons of the men dwell, or beasts of the field, or birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. So here again, sovereignty. It's written in every chapter throughout this book. Who gives men their kingdoms and gives them their rule? God does. And that brings up a point. What about some of these barbarous rulers? We've seen a number up throughout Croatia, the former Yugoslavian country up there that broke up into several small countries. What about, Milosevic, and different ones that came to power? You say, how could someone like that come to power? How about Idi Amin in Uganda? And different rulers, even the genocide going on over there in the Sudan right now. Who could put these people in power? And what in the world is the U.S. doing supporting and talking with these dictators? Well, they're trying to get them to, I think, come to their senses and quit slaughtering their people. And you say, well, how could God let someone like that be in power?
Read 1 Peter 2, 13 and 14.
Go ahead and read it.
It says, submit yourself to the, for the Lord's sake, to every human institution, king, whether to a king as one authority, and here's the one, or to a government, or to governors as sent by him for punishment of evildoers, and the praise of those who do right.
And Romans 13 is another good chapter, that we are to submit to our governing authorities. Does that mean we obey them where it contradicts the word of God? No, but be ready to die if you don't, right? Depending on what country you're in. The point of God's sovereignty is he is in control. He put this man in control, and he is going to leave him in control as long as he wants him to be in control, and then he's going to remove him. He says in verse 39, after you. Oh, bummer. Let's not talk about that. Let's talk about verse 38 and how I'm the head of gold and I'm the head of this statue. I'm the best. I'm the purest form of government. Let's not talk about how after me, another's going to arise, another kingdom inferior to you. Then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth, Alexander the Great. And then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. Rome in their ultimate dominance and their fierceness, and heavy like iron, they just crushed everyone that stood in their way. And in that you saw that the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, this will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. In that you saw that the iron mixed with the common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. This is such an amazing four prediction, a prediction of the European Union. Do any of them over there like each other? They're extremely nationalistic. The French hate everybody. The Italians, it's the Italians only, and they're the Papi, the Holy Father is there, and the true church is there, and they're extremely nationalistic. The Germans think everybody needs to be destroyed except for the Aryans. It's a crazy mix of people over there. But they're coming together, aren't they? They're talking now about a constitution. And the majority of the smaller nations that have been added in recent years, they don't want nothing to do with the European constitution of the EU, because that has basically to do with the nations, the 10 nations that formed the old Roman Empire, which is Britain, Spain, Portugal, France, Italy, the nations right around the Mediterranean that I believe in the end, when it all shakes out, those will be the 10 toes, and this constitution favors them. And so the other nations, these other, what is there, 26 now, so this other 15 or so, as you read articles coming from over in Europe, they're not real happy with the constitution. They don't want it. And the one that's really pushing for it is the Chancellor of Germany, the woman over there, what's her name, Miliki, whatever her name is, she's really speaking out on it. Tony Blair's not real wild about it. None of them get along. France says, forget all of you. And so I think this is just an amazing description of the toes, where this statue ends up. Coming out of Rome are the feet and the 10 toes, and that's the last, if you will, the reformation of the old Roman Empire, the last of the Gentile powers. But just look at that. They don't adhere to one another. They don't get along. And yet for the purposes of coming together for strength, they will come together. And in verse 44, and in the days of those kings. So it's, what is this? This is the days of these final 10 kings, the 10 toes. What are the 10 toes? They are 10 kings. Doesn't that refer right back to verse 43? In the days of these 10 kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. That kingdom will not be left to another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it itself will endure forever. The God of heaven, in the days, the final form of this Roman Empire, the God of heaven is going to establish his kingdom that's going to destroy all these Gentile kingdoms. Verse 45, inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present to him an offering and a fragrant incense. The king answered Daniel and said, surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief perfect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made request of the king that he might appoint Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. Who had prayed with Daniel for this interpretation? Beginning of chapter 2, you remember that? The king had a dream, said everybody dies if you don't interpret it. They couldn't interpret it. The decree went forth. Daniel went in and said, give me a little time, O king, and I believe I can make this matter known to you. Then he ran home and got his three buddies and said, fellas, we got to pray like we never prayed before. If not, we're all dead men. If God isn't pleased to grant this request, we are all dead. So his three partners pray with him, and then they kind of fade from the story. He's the one that's taken in before the king. He's the one interprets the dream. He's the one that gets all the presents and prizes. And so now he speaks up for his three buddies and says, Lord, king, can you appoint them as well to serve with me, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, over the administration of the provinces of Babylon? And so the king said, let it be so. And so here we see the king is given the dream. And here again, if he had forgotten it, now he remembers it. That's not important, as Howard said earlier. The point is, he knows that this was the dream. He's secure with it. And Daniel just spells it out. And the thing I think that made the king happy was he's the head of gold, because in chapter 3, we're going to see that he makes a statue of pure gold, saying, I'm not going to be just a head of gold. There's this God that I don't really know about. I'm just starting to learn about him. He claims sovereignty. Well, he says, I'm the king that's sovereign for now. I am the head of gold. And so in chapter 3, we'll see he's going to make an image completely of gold and demand that everybody worship it. And it's a test of faith for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, isn't it? And how are they going to do when the pressure's on? And we're going to see they do marvelously well when the pressure's on them. Any questions on... keep this at hand, because when we get to get over to chapter 7, we'll fill it in with this next... with this one here, with just a different look at these different kingdoms as they're pictured as ravenous beasts. That's how God views us as Gentile kings and Gentile people. We just want to have control over everything. And he's going to picture these kingdoms and as different animals, as ravaging beasts who want dominance. So we'll look at the counterpart of that. And we've given you another... And you could work ahead if you like, comparison between 2 and 7 for coming up for the future as well. Any questions over this statue thus far, or what we looked at last week and this week? Does it make sense to you? This is an interpretation, right? It's an interpretation of what we're seeing here in chapter 2. And what we're suggesting to you is that the four kingdoms here are Babylon, who was taken over by Medo-Persia, who was taken over by Greece, who was taken over by Rome. And there's some that would say, well, there's been other kingdoms besides the fourth. Well, from God's perspective, we might say that there has been, but God says, no, there hasn't. There's been four. And that's, in my opinion, why Hitler didn't succeed where he should have. He had dominance. He had everything in place to succeed, but he didn't. That's why Japan didn't succeed when they took us out. Just think about it. If they thought that all of our fleet was at Pearl, that they were going to completely take us out. But as you go back and read the history of it, was that Admiral Nimitz had gone on maneuvers and they were secret, and so half of the fleet was not there. And that half of the fleet and others that were on the West Coast, one of the aircraft carriers and some others, that were in for retrofitting, their retrofitting was about done, so that the tide changed so quickly. How is that possible? Because they had us. They would have had us. And you say, well, no, because they would have still had to come and take over our country. But you see the point. God said four and no more. I think that's interesting. And in the South Pacific theater, like Truk Island was one of the major. Truk Island has a huge natural reef that runs around it, and it's a natural harbor. And that was the Japanese's Pearl Harbor, and we caught them there with it full of ships. And that's one of the leading diving places that people go to dive among these wrecked ships is Truk Island. Just a beautiful. Natural harbor. So just key things like that, where God is still sovereign and tips the balance. Let me close this in a word of prayer, and then I'd like to ask Martin. We haven't had an opportunity to hear how your mission trip went this summer. I've got 5 minutes. Maybe you could give us just a quick synopsis of some of the great things God did.